You never know what's coming at you from the blue, clear sky. And my next guest, Calvin Parker, learned that lesson the hard way when he was 19 years old. That's back on October 11th, 1973. He and a friend, Charles Hickson, were spending an evening fishing in Mississippi, and something came out of the sky and changed both of their lives forever. Charles Hickson has talked about his experience more than once and wrote a book about it, co-wrote a book. But Calvin is different. He didn't want to talk about it, and for 45 years has tried to get away from it. Now he's told his story in a new book, Pascagoula, The Closest Encounter, My Story by Calvin Parker. And it's the first time he's ever been on this program. He joins us in just a moment. As I mentioned a moment ago, October 1973, Charles Hickson and young Calvin Parker went fishing and had an experience that it hit Mississippi sort of like a Category 5 hurricane. A media storm followed the experience that these two men reported to the sheriff and to the military. And then for the next 45 years, Calvin Parker tried to get away from it. He tried to bury that story and forget about it and not talk about it. He has finally agreed to come forward. And Calvin, I got to welcome you to the program. So glad you're with us.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
I just want to tell you, you don't know me, but you're among friends here, and I know we're going to get into what some reporters and others have done to you over the years and tricks they pulled and words they put into your mouth. We're not going to do that here. We want you to tell your story in your own words, and we're anxious to hear it, and so glad you came forward, and so glad you wrote the book after so long. I guess Philip Mantle gets some of the credit for that, huh?
He almost gets 100% for it. Actually, I wasn't even interested in writing a book when this happened, and we were at a wake at a funeral home, and somebody recognized my name on the book where we logged in. So on my way home, my wife said, maybe you ought to write a book. When we got home, for some reason, Philip Mandrell had sent me an email wanting to talk about it.
That's quite a coincidence.
it was. So I just put the two of it together. And it was time for me to get out and talk about it, because I've never talked to my family about it. I've never talked to friends about it. Actually, no one ever asked me, and I never talked. The people that knew me didn't ask me. So I never wanted to talk about it. And so Philip hit the perfect time.
I notice I don't want to give away too much about the ending, but I will say this, is that you recommend at the end of this book, which is very candid, very down-to-earth, matter-of-fact, you recommend that anybody else who has that experience, that they come forward, that they talk about it, because you sort of burying that story, it did you no good over all these years, right?
No, because my life would have been totally different if this hadn't happened. I had a direction in my life that I wanted to take, and after this, it was no taking a direction. It was job to job, hiding when somebody found out who you was, just getting up, moving overnight, not telling nobody where you were. But some way, people find you, and the more cell phones and computers that was out there, the easier it was to find you. So I just gave up the run, bought a house on the coast, and still have them every now and then. Before this book, they still used to come by the house uninvited and just more or less barge in on your privacy and all.
Well, I can relate to that. Let me ask you this. Prior to October 1973, were you interested in UFOs? Did you read UFO books? Did you watch it? You know, were you checking out stories? No.
No, sir. I was a little country farm boy. We farmed, and I worked in the oil field, and I didn't have time to. Well, one thing, it was three stations on TV, and they always covered the president. And the next thing, you know, you didn't have the news. You didn't have access to computers or books or anything like that. So I didn't even really know what a UFO was.
So there's no family stories or anything. We'll get into that a little bit later, but there, you know, it's not something you talk about among your friends.
No, no, sir. Matter of fact, it hadn't been long ago. One of my good friends was sitting around talking. He said, what you been doing? You been gone. I said, well, I think I'm going to write a book. He said, write a book about what? And I told him. He said, you know, you've told me a many a lies over the years, but you never lied to me about that because you never talked to me about that. And when he talks about the lies, we're talking about fishing lies and stuff, but actually I never even lied about my fishing.
Tell me about Charles Hickson. He was a friend of your father's and a lot older than you, but you guys became friends and you ended up working with him, right?
I did. Like I say, I was in an oil field. I lived in Laurel, Mississippi, and Charles had lived in Laurel or Sandersville. So I got to know him through my father. We used to all fish together, his children and me and my brother and him, Daddy. We'd all go fishing and camping out and stuff. And that was pretty much the sum of it there. So my job was 7 days a week, 16 hours a day in an oil field. So I wanted to change jobs. I was in the process of getting married. Matter of fact, the following November after this October. And Daddy said, well, call Charlie. He's on the coast working on a shipyard. He might hire you. So that's how I ended up down here on the coast with Charlie. So I paid him all. When I moved down here, he said, well, just rent a room for me till you see how this is going to work, till you get your place. So I was there 2 days before all this happened.
So you guys wanted to slip out and do a little fishing after work on October 11th, October 11th.
Yes, sir, that's true. We'd worked all day. We brassed in that morning at the shipyard and didn't get off till late that evening. And Charlie said, well, let's go fishing. Let's wind down a little bit. We both like to fish. Let's just go fishing. I know a good spot. So I never had really ever fished down here. I didn't know anything about the coast. I said, well, let's go. I said, I don't have no fishing equipment, Charlie. Charlie said, that's okay. I got plenty. So we went to his house, loaded up the fishing equipment, and went down to an old shipyard that Charlie knew that had been abandoned. And that's where we originally started out fishing. Used to be a grain elevator there, and Charlie said, oh, a lot of fish come up and eat where they unload the grain out of the barges. It falls off in the water. The fish come up and feed on it. We're going to catch a lot of fish. Of course, we wasn't there long enough to catch anything. So,
tell me the story. You caught a couple of fish that I never heard of before. It's a kind that I'd never heard.
It's a trash fish. It looks like a hardhead, but like a catfish, but they call it a hardhead down here, and they're a trash fish. They're just kind of long and skinny, except they're not meaty or anything, and we just throw them back and still do till today. But we had got up on 90 and drove down to the shipyard where he was talking about. It's about a 15-minute ride from his house. So when we got there and parked the car, I kind of looked out, and there was a lot of talking about trash on the ground and all. And I said, Charlie, this place is a mess. Why don't they ever clean it up? He said, well, Calvin, they do, but what happens, the tide or the water will get high, or a storm will come by and get the water up over the lot. And then when it goes out, it just leaves a trash that it brought in for people's houses and everything else. And the marsh grass was really tall. So we parked and we walked about 300 foot down to the river and got down there and got kind of set up. And I remember sitting on that pier and looking across the river that's called the East Bank on the Pascagoula. I was looking across, and there was a Coast Guard ship there made out of steel. And I was thinking to myself, how in the world does something made out of steel float? But, you know, it was sitting up there big, tall, and proud floating. And then about that time, I seen some lights reflecting across the water from behind us, some blue lights. I told Charlie, I said, I believe the law's here to make us move or to check us out or something. Oh, no, they don't never mess with you, although it was a trespassing sign, no trespassing sign up there. But Charlie didn't pay it no attention because it had grown up around it. And so we stood up, when the blue lights was behind us, we just automatically stood up, turned around and looked, and it was too late to go anywhere because there was water on the left, water on the right, water in the front, and there was something that we've never seen before in the back. And all of a sudden, the blue lights just disappeared, and a big, bright, bluish-looking light come out of the, and I say bluish, it was so bright, it was really hard to tell any color, come out of this thing that had landed behind us, which later, you know, we decided it was some kind of UFO. And you couldn't really make out what was coming out of it until it got about half to you because that light was so blinding. It just kind of three blurs about halfway down through there. And I still didn't realize what it was. But the closer they got, the more you realize what it was. And I mean, they moved on, coming across the top of all that grass and all. And when they got closer to us, I noticed they was floating instead of walking through there. So two of these things got a hold of Charlie. One got a hold of myself. And immediately, when they grabbed me by the arm, it just relaxed me because I feel like they might have gave me some kind of injection or something just to relax us. So now this is the last time I seen Charlie there because I couldn't move, and they turned and faced the craft, turned me, and I was facing the craft, and I was going in, so I couldn't turn my head to the left or right or anything. And we was going straight into the craft, but I did notice we was floating across the top of the grass, probably a couple of foot. And that was really strange to me. Now, I could keep my thoughts about me, but I didn't have no control over my body whatsoever. So when we got to the craft, he immediately took a turn. Then he turned back and put me into I call it an examination room. But the one thing I noticed when we went into the craft, I was wondering about the blue light, the bright lights, and there wasn't no light fixtures inside. It just seemed to all be coming out of the walls. So it looked like it was coming out of the paint, the lights did. It was so bright.
What did these things look like that came and grabbed you?
They was probably, I'm going to say four and a half, 5 foot tall at the most. And they didn't have a neck, but their heads just sat down on their shoulders, and they had skin or maybe a suit or something on. I'm going to call these robots because when they moved, they just moved. You can look at something and tell when it's mechanical, and they just had a mechanical movement about them and kind of grayish-looking skin on them. And their hands look like a kid's mittens. When you go out in the winter and play, you put mittens on, you know, it covers the four fingers and leaves the thumbs out.
Sure.
I call them crab-like hands. So,
no eyes, anyhow. No mouth.
Now, this is where Charlie and I differ a little bit because I didn't see any facial features on them, but Charlie did. And we talked about this a little later. But I think the lights, my eyes were still trying to adjust to the lights. And maybe I didn't get as good a look at them as what he did in the face. Because they was kind of on the side of me, and I couldn't turn my head or look around. But I got a little better look now when they got us in and put us on an examination table, or what I thought, say, is going to be an examination table. I know they just laid us back on about a 45-degree angle. I couldn't feel a table or anything or didn't see one, but we was laying there stationary, so it had to be something they laid us on, I guess.
So your body is essentially frozen, but your mind is active. You must be had all kinds of thoughts going through your head.
Oh, yeah. If anybody gets in that situation and not scared, you know, you don't. You keep thinking, well, maybe I'm dead or something like that. This might be the end of it. And really, you know, I accepted death right then. I'm going to call it the big ugly one. After he led us in there, he kind of backed up a little bit, and there was a more presentable looking humanoid creature come out from behind somewhere. And I didn't see a door open. I didn't see it in there, or her in there, when they come out. But I'm assuming it was a her, just the way she was built, a little smaller and narrower, and kind of had a body shape to her. But I looked to see, and you know, she was feminine looking, or he was feminine looking, and I didn't see no breast or anything on it, you know, it's scooting out of a uniform. And but they come out and took my face and pulled around on my face with her hands, and she had different hands than what this other one did. They was more like a hand, you know, she had a thumb and I think three fingers on her. I don't remember counting exactly, but I do know the middle one was a little longer. Didn't have any texture that I felt when she was giving me what I call the examination, but she was pulling around on my skin and trying to look in my mouth. But first of all, before we get to that part, there's something that come out of the ceiling about the size of a deck of cards, and it floated down just above my head, and it went from between my eyes, my head, about a foot up probably. Then it went to my right ear. And every time it would move, it would click. And it did that four times. It went from front, top to side to back to side, then back to the front. And then it just disappeared. And this thing was about the size of a deck of cards. I did see some silver and blue on it. Now, it's hard to describe it exactly other than that. And that's when the other feminine-looking creature come out and did, you know, pull it around on my face and my skin and all. And I was starting to come out of the daze. I think I was fixing to get to where I could move. So maybe the sedation that they gave me was wearing off, because I was thinking in my mind, well, you know, I'll grab her around the neck, we'll get out of here, and I'll have me a trophy at the house. But she must have known what was going to happen, because she come in and it was like reading my mind. She knew exactly what I was thinking. She said, don't panic, don't be afraid. And that she didn't verbally say it. I didn't see her mouth move, but she must have been thinking this in. I figure it was telepathically. And then, don't be afraid, don't move. And I calmed down when she said that, because I knew if she could read my mind, I was just messed up anyway. So all of a sudden, she made a noise from the bottom of her throat. It was like a click, click, click. And this big ugly one come back in, and he immediately grabbed me by the arm, and that's when I relaxed again. Now, the thing that seemed really weird to me about this, they levitated us off the ground about 2 foot, and I was wondering, how did this keep from breaking my arm off when this? And I wasn't about to try to fight that one, because it looked like it was sure enough serious about stuff. And there's no way. Well, I don't believe anybody could have won a battle with that little one. So they levitated me back up, the big ugly one. And this other one went back off somewhere. I never heard a door open or seen her go in a door, another door in there. But she just faded back in the back somewhere. And he carried us back out the same place. He had picked me up, except I was facing the river this time. My arms stretched out, and I was standing up. And it was just like I was paralyzed in that position for a second. And that's when I heard Charlie for the first time. Calvin, you okay, son? And, you know, I could hear his voice. And then I freed up, and automatically you're going to turn around and look to see if you need to run or what you need to do. So when I turned around and looked, these things was already back to the craft, and the big bright light, they must have closed the door. The big bright light just went off, and I heard like a little zipping noise, not loud, but just enough to get your attention. And it
hold on, Calvin, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're talking with Calvin Parker about his amazing experience at Pascagoula. We're taking a break right now. We'll pick up the story in a moment. We're hearing a mesmerizing story from Calvin Parker, my first-time guest on Coast to Coast, about Pascagoula, the closest encounter, this amazing story of his encounter, October of 1973. In just a moment, we'll hear what happens next, and then the media invasion unfolds. We'll be right back. Our conversation with Calvin Parker continues. Calvin, I'll tell you, what makes this book ring true for me are some of the very small details that you include, very personal and candid observations and thoughts that are going through your head at the time. I remember in particular, you mentioned about the fishing equipment. You didn't have any fishing gear, your own stuff. And Charles Hickson had offered to go out that night to loan you some, and you observed that's sort of like sleeping with somebody else's wife is to use their fishing gear.
Yeah, that's exactly the way it is down here in the South with a true fisherman. You had rather sleep with a wife than borrow their fishing equipment because you get away with it a lot faster.
Well, those kind of details really make it an interesting read. So you get out of the you're floated into this craft. They do a sort of a medical scanning and observation of the two of you. Then you're floated out, and this thing takes off in a blur. It's gone. Do the two of you leave right away, or you stand there and kind of talk about it, or what?
No, sir. Actually, Charlie still had his pretty good wits about him. I wanted to leave. I wanted to just get out of there. Charlie said, let's sit down and talk about this for a minute. So we sat down on a pier. There was no log there, and we just sat down on the log and carried on a conversation, a normal conversation for just a few minutes, not long. And we talked about it. I said, Charlie, now, I don't want nobody to know about this. He said, well, I agree with you, son. Nobody needs to know about this. So we did agree on that pretty much before we left. So I was getting kind of antsy. We just grabbed up the fishing equipment. We left and made our way back to the car, and seemed like we made it back to the car faster than what we made it down there because we was ready to go. When we got to the car, I kind of looked through the windows. I hadn't locked the doors, but I looked back to the other side, and the window was shattered. That was a brand-new little car at the time. And the window was just shattered in place. It was still staying there, but it was shattered on the passenger side. So we opened the door. When Charlie opened it, it all just fell to the ground. And, you know, it had that safety. That was safety glass, so the plastic was inside the window. You could pick up a piece of it and still feel the plastic in it. We got in the car, started trying to crank it. It was probably 10, 15 minutes before we could finally get the car cranked. Now, the one thing that I noticed, and it was amazing to me, if you cranked on a car that long, that battery's going to get weak. This battery seemed stronger than ever in the car. When you would go to crank it, it would spin the motor like a top. So we eventually got it cranked. It was running a little bit rough. We put it in reverse, pulled out, got on the road, going down the road. And Charlie said, I got to tell somebody. I said, no, hell no, Charlie. Let's don't tell nobody. Let's keep this to ourselves, because what we're going to do, we tell somebody, we're going to lose our jobs. We're going to be thrown in jail and everything else. He said, no, I got to tell somebody. So we was, back then, there was no cell phones whatsoever. Neither one of us had a watch. So we went to a little local store, and I'm thinking in my mind it was a Magic Mart store. So we pulled up, and it was a payphone. Now, they locked the streets down in the South down here when it got dark at this in 73. You didn't find a business open nowhere. I mean, not nothing. You was just way out of luck. If you needed gas or groceries or anything like that, you could give that up. It had blue laws, and the buildings was locked down after a certain time. So we pulled up, and Charlie got on the phone, and the first thing he did was call Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi. And he said, and I couldn't hear what he was saying from the car because I sat in the car, but he told me that he told him that he wanted to talk to somebody there about what had happened. And they told him that they didn't take stories like this anymore, investigations like this, and hadn't done it since the 60s, and for him to call the local authorities. So he come back to the car and said, I'm calling the sheriff department, because that was the local authorities. And that's what he did. He called the sheriff department, and they said, automatically told him, y'all don't drive nowhere, because I can imagine what's going through their mind. two drunk country boys out here going to get on the road and kill somebody in the drive. So we stayed right there. It wasn't just a few minutes. They showed up, two patrol cars, or two patrolmen in a car, and I think one of them was a detective and the other was a patrol officer. So they got out and they walked around the cars, each side, and they looked inside the car, you know, just from the outside, asked us to step out. So we stepped out, and they, me and I was sitting under a stern wheel. They had me out there doing field sobriety tests to see if we'd been drinking. We was jumping up and down on one foot, trying to touch her nose, doing all kind of dumb stuff. I couldn't do it now, me being sober. I was sober then, but I couldn't do that now because I'm a little older. So they, anyhow, they got through with us, said, okay, y'all follow us back to the sheriff's department. I thought, yeah, I know this trick. We're going to follow y'all back, and y'all going to lock us up. But thinking to myself, I'd rather be in jail. At least you'll be surrounded with people with guns and stuff than what you would sitting out there in the middle of a lot fishing and something come out of the sky and get you. So we did follow them back. We got to the sheriff's department, and they separated us. They took him into a room, and the other one took me into a room. And they started asking us what had happened, and we talked to them. Of course, I didn't tell them nothing because me and Charlie had talked on the way over. I said, Charlie, I didn't want nobody to know this. I said, I'm not talking to him. He said, just tell him you don't remember, you passed out or something. I said, oh, okay.
So that was your story. Yeah, that was your story then when you were at the sheriff's office.
That was my story, and I'm sticking to it. Because for some reason, when I came out, I had a feeling that I didn't need to talk about this yet. I didn't need to tell nobody. I figured one thing, it would destroy my life because, you know, not just everybody gets abducted in a physical all at one time. So I said, well, this will destroy your life. It's just not believable. It's not credible. And I'm not going to talk about it. And I could see me going home and explaining to the girl I was engaged to, her daddy, because he was hard-nosed. I mean, if you went on a date, you supposed to be back at 10:30 or 11. You better be straight up and down the time. You better get back there. So I could imagine what he would say if I got caught riding a UFO. I'd rather get caught drinking because, you know, he was a teetotaler. He didn't drink nothing or anything. Of course, I didn't back then, really. I had a beer sometime after this. But anyhow, getting back to the story, they separated us, and then all at one time, they brought us back and put us in the same room. And we started talking about it. And little did we know there was a tape recorder inside the room there, and they was taping our conversations.
So they had left the room and let you guys talk about it among yourselves.
They did. They throwed us in there and act like they was going somewhere. And they had a tape recorder hid. And I guess this is pretty standard for interrogations and all. Back then, I didn't know it. You know, I was young and kind of stupid. I didn't care. But they got this tape. And I still didn't know it was a tape recorder in the room. Even after they came back, I seen one of them reach in a drawer and get something. And they walked to another room together. And then the sheriff walked in, and all three of them listened to the tape, I'm assuming. I didn't see them listening to it, but I'm assuming they listened to the tape. And the sheriff at the time was Fred Diamond. He walked in, and he said, y'all go ahead, y'all go on home or wherever you want to go, y'all free to go. But they did say, let me tell you one thing, if this is a hoax, and I think this was a scare tactic they was trying, if this was a hoax, y'all going to jail for a long time. And I said, well, you know, I was thinking to myself, I told him, I said, you know what, fella, jail will beat where I've been, so go ahead and lock me up. I can sleep tonight in jail, but if I'm leaving this world, I don't want to, you know, I won't be able to sleep.
You write in the book that you think that they believed you, though, after they heard that tape of you guys talking about it amongst yourselves that they believed you.
You could see the fear in their face. They got afraid then. And I was really wanting them to go with me and let's go back to the location and let's search the location. At the time, everything was fresh. Treat it like a crime scene because two reasons. Number one, I needed to file an insurance claim on my car, and I knew if I went to my insurance company and told them a UFO broke the windows out of it, I knew that wasn't going to be real credible. So, but I figured if they would write it and report about something, that it'd be all right, but they wouldn't even do that. Now, I heard later that they did go back down and look around, but I'm not for sure about that. I'm not sure they did or not. So, anyhow, we left that night, went home, and on the way home, I was worried about some kind of bacteria or radiation or something. I told Charlie, I said, you know, we might need to go get checked for some kind of bacteria or be condemned or put off into a place. And the reason I even thought about that, I knew, had seen these Apollo spaceships or something. When they get them in the ocean, they quarantine them for 6 or 7 days.
Yeah.
And I knew this was out of the world where we had been, and I just felt like we needed it. But he said, oh, we'll take care of all that later. Don't worry about it. So I remember when we got home, I got a trash bag. It wasn't a trash bag. It was a big paper bag like groceries used to come in back then. And I went into the room. I pulled off all my clothes. I pulled my shoes off. I put everything in that bag. I took a shower with bleach. There was a little quart thing of bleach sitting on in there, I guess, where she had been cleaning the commodes and stuff with. I got that and I poured it on me. I got wet and I just poured the bleach on me and washed off with that. So when I got out of the shower, I put on some clean clothes and I got that bag and I walked out and threw it in a dumpster on the outside. And I still was concerned about all of it. And so the next morning we got up and Charlie and Ben was in there drinking coffee. Now I didn't know if he had told his family anything about what was going on or not right then. So I didn't say nothing because I wasn't for sure if he wanted them to know or if he wanted to worry them. So we got in the car, left, and went back to work. When we got to work, you got a little piece of brass that you got a number on it. You just hand it into the little building, and they hang it on a nail, and somebody comes by and writes down what time you got there and what time you leave. It's just like a time clock.
Mm-hmm.
So we brassed in and went to went to our workstations. While we weren't started real good yet, we got a call from the office. Now, I noticed a lot of different cars there when we pulled up, but I didn't know who they were. I had no idea somebody had leaked this in the press. Actually, I thought it was all kind of over with, except for the fear part of having some kind of disease or radiation or something. So they called for Charlie and I to come to the office, and I got out in the parking lot, and I was on my hands and knees throwing up because I knew I lost my job, I lost my car, and I just lost everything, I figured. So we went to the office, sat down, and they said, we got an attorney coming to handle this because we need some help. Our office, our business is shut down over something that happened to y'all. We want y'all to tell the story to him. So we did. And it was shut down. The phones was ringing. They couldn't conduct any kind of business because of the reporters calling and all. And I was wondering to myself, who in the world told them? What happened? Who told these people what had happened? So when their attorney, Joe Flamingo, got there, he asked us what had happened. We explained to him, and we had mentioned that we needed to go probably get an examination from the local hospital and check for radiation. Now, I would have done this just backwards if I was them. I would have went to the radiation check at Kiesler first, then went to the hospital. But they didn't. They took us to the hospital first, and they gave us an examination. And a couple of things they determined. One, where this had got a hold of my arm, there was a rip and a puncture mark on it. And the next thing, I don't know what come out in the blood work. Have no clue. Because when Katrina come by, it destroyed all the records. Back in, you didn't have computers to store them on, so you couldn't put them in a file somewhere and hide them back. So anyhow, after the physical, we had the sheriff department put us in their car and take us to Kiesler. And when we got to the Air Force base, they escorted us right in, and Kiesler had a car sitting there, and they escorted us back to somewhere in the back. And there was several people sitting around with what I call radiation suits on and Geiger counters. We got out of the car. They escorted us up to that, the sheriff did, or the deputy did. And they took these Geiger counters and went all over us. And I heard one of them said, they clear. So they took off their suits, and one of them walked up to us and said, they want to see you inside. I said, well, okay. I really didn't want, I wanted to leave. But, because I've never heard no stories about anybody going to the Air Force base or anything like that back then, but with seeing a UFO. So they escorted us inside. When we got there, it was several officials there. In the book, somehow Philip had got a hold of the manuscripts on the meeting there, and he's got it documented who all was in there and all. But you could tell it was several high-ranking officials from the military, and then they had some local officials from the local government there. They sat down and interviewed us, questioned us a little bit, really nice people, and they told us, well, y'all can go. And that's where it ended right there, and they took us back to the shipyard then. And that's when they told us, y'all need to take some time off because we can't conduct business with y'all in here. But during the meantime, Charlie had went by. There was this guy that worked for Charlie that was an artist, Larry Flint, I believe was his name. And he sat down and talked with Larry and described what he had seen. And Larry asked me what I seen. I told him I didn't see nothing. There was no facial features or nothing. So this was starting the whole deal then. But I was curious. I asked him, I asked the sheriff department, I said, how did the press find out about this? Because they was hounding us then and hounding the shipyard. So they got their attorney to give some kind of little press release at the shipyard so we wouldn't have to deal with them. And it wouldn't interfere with their business that much. And the only thing that I could figure out, or we could figure out, is back then you didn't have cell phones, you didn't have computers, but everybody had scanners that they would listen to the fire department, the sheriff department, and the highway.
Sure.
Just being nosy, trying to figure out some kind of entertainment of what's going on. And I figured probably when the sheriff department called it in, they might have let it slip. They was going to see a couple of guys about a UFO abduction. So that's the
only tell you
way
what,
I
hold on here.
This,
let me interrupt you for a second, Calvin. We're going to have to take another break. A lot more to come here. This story gets really complicated in a big hurry with the waves of media that just won't take no for an answer. Calvin Parker, my story, Pascagoula, the closest encounter is the topic. We'll be right back.